Welcome to the Sound Effect Podcast, the podcast about sound effects. My name is Asbjørn Andersen, and I'm the founder of asoundeffect.com.
And I'm Christian Halskjær, founder of Hertz & Bits Sound Effects.
And what's on the menu for this episode?
Well, we are in for a bit of a field recording treat here. Jennifer Walden spoke to Mattia Gilotto about his new sound library, Animal Hyperrealism 3. Mattia is a full-time sound designer and a part-time field recordist. And in this interview, he talks about how he gets those super clean animal recordings that we can hear in his libraries and how his whole approach to that has developed.
Sounds good. And as always, there have been some interesting new releases from the independent sound effects community as well.
Yes, this time we have some mechanical clock sounds. We have some boat horns, a collection of strange instruments, and some desert field recordings from the Arabian Peninsula.
Well, let's hear it.
Strange Instruments by Collected Transients is a collection of wild and unconventional instrument sound effects. You don't hear these every day. Clocks and Mechanics by Just Sound Effects provides you with recordings of grandfather clocks, wall clocks, desk clocks, pocket watches, and many other small mechanisms. Arabian Desert by Mindful Audio is a collection of stereo and quad soundscapes recorded on the Arabian Peninsula, in the Empty Quarter, the largest expanse of sand dunes on Earth. Boat Horns by Sound Taylor captures one of the largest boat horns collections in the world. Next up is an interview with Mattia Gilotto about his new animal sound library.
Hey, this is Jennifer Walden here with Mattia Gilotto to talk about his newest sound effects library release, Animal Hyperrealism 3. Mattia is a sound designer and field recordist, and chances are you've used some of his recordings in your work. He's put out collections of sounds like Polarity, which is full of electricity and science-related sounds, Rock's Momentum, Metal Slams and Groans, and of course, the Animal Hyperrealism libraries. Hello, Mattia. Thanks for joining me. You know, your Animal Hyperrealism libraries come up in my conversations with sound designers so often, like such a huge hit. And so I'm so thrilled to be talking with you about your latest release.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. Yeah.
So this is actually your third Animal Hyperrealism release. In this new collection, you cover a wide range of animals, from the Congo gray parrot, which is my particular favorite because it does all of these really neat mimic sounds. Just sounds so cute. to big guttural sounds of this Central European boar. To the northern white-cheeked gibbon, which is this interesting-sounding monkey. It's such a wide variety of animal sounds. that are all super clean, of course, and super close mic'd. I mean, it's like you stuck a boar in a booth and like had him perform for you. It's that clean. So what was your motivation for creating this new collection? What did you hope to achieve with this collection that you didn't maybe get to do in the previous two collections?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not 100% sure of what I was trying to achieve, but maybe I can give you a bit of an insight over why I decided to start in the first place. Because generally speaking, for me, field recording is a part-time job since I work full-time in game development during my average day. I pretty much go with the flow, try not to create goals that are too big to pursue. So in the case of Animal Hyperrealism Volume 1, that was just dictated by the fact that one of the things that I love doing is just changing the theme constantly. So if I work on electricity, one day I'd love to work on rock smashes or ice crackling on another day. So I have never really worked with animal sounds before, or at least not to an extent where I thought I had to push any form of boundary. So the first library was an excuse to do that. And at the time I was living in the UK, so I had the chance to get some clean recordings because I was able to organize recording sessions with, quite literally, we were pretty close to being in a booth with not a boar, but perhaps, a crow or a raven. So that was good. And on the second library, I decided, well, that worked within the boundaries of the UK and a bit of time spent in Italy when I was home for holidays or, yeah, for Christmas. For number three, if I'm honest, I think I have become a little bit addicted to the idea of going to either the wild animal parks or any kind of animal interaction at this point. I really love trying to understand how animals behave and not having to talk or direct or do anything because I have no power whatsoever on the animal, unless it's a parrot, in which case you can try to have some form of exchange. But yeah, for number three, I think the goal was just pretty much to go out and record. And I think for at least half of the recordings, I forgot that at one point I would have to edit them. So I really spent a lot of time out recording. And so for, you know, when I got halfway, I realized, okay, this is another library then. And at that point, it got a little bit more serious and it got a little bit more kind of thought through in terms of planning, etc. But I think the motivation for me is just to get out, keep recording, and wait for something special, really. I think that way I look at it a little bit like Pokemons, you know, like you go out and you try to record the rarest possible sound. And, you know, if it happens, it happens. And if it doesn't happen, that's fine. Again, another great thing about doing it part-time is the fact that I don't go to an animal park with any form of expectations. I'll just go in. If something cool happens, that's great. And if it doesn't, next time.
So how do you prepare for doing a library? If you don't set out to record a specific animal, what's your preparation like instead? Do you look at the animal parks that have a great selection of animals, or how do you approach that?
Yeah, it's a bit of a mixture. I think my first step is always to open Google Maps and look for animal parks, zoos, sometimes animal shops, but only if perhaps they also host temporarily, for example, birds. If someone is on holiday and they may have like a section where you have a number of birds that are there for a given amount of time. So I will filter all of the destinations like this. And then I will look through the list of animal guests that they have. And if there is something that is particularly interesting from a sound recording point of view, I will try to investigate the best chance possible to get a sound from that animal. For example, for the rutting deers, which are one of my favorite animals, I pretty much found out about the location, which is the closest one that I have to my current home in Malmo in Sweden. And I realized that for those, I would have had to wait until September of the year after. So that was a lot of planning, deciding to, for example, book an overnight stay and give myself 48 hours to capture as much as possible. The same thing applies in some way to smaller recording sessions. For example, for seagulls, there is a very specific season during which in Malmo, you get just woken up by seagulls. So you might as well go out and record them. So you just kind of take a note of when that happens. And if you don't feel like doing it exactly on that day, you know that maybe you have like, I guess, 2 weeks or so to act if you really want the seagull sounds, and then perhaps they will kind of calm down a little. But yeah, depending on the animal, you may have to do more or less research, because some animal behaviors are more seasonal, whereas others are more of a daily routine. If you think about the feeding of pigs or boars, in that case, you would think, okay, then I just need to be there before the feeding time. So you will talk with, for example, a keeper in an animal park. If they know the routine, then they will be expecting the food. And if you are there just before the food arrives, then you will likely get a chance of recording some interesting vocalizations. That doesn't always work because, for example, in the case of pigs, I went one time during the summer to a park and I got amazing recordings. Then I went to the same park in winter, and because just before winter, a tree gave a lot of fruits and they felt pretty fed throughout the day, they were not so demanding for food when I showed up. So yeah, there's things that no matter how much you plan, you really would need to know the very specific micro changes that can happen that could potentially affect a recording session.
So do you feel like it's worth it to go back to a place and capture the same animal twice?
If I feel that I have visited a place and I got in as much as possible, it is possible that I won't come back. But at the same time, I tend to overthink how much I could have recorded, what I could have done a little bit better. The weather could have been a little bit less windy. The conditions may have not been perfect for other reasons. There were maybe distant works that I might have picked up that will require some extra denoising. So at times I won't even edit the content and I will just tell myself, let's go back next week. And but generally speaking, I don't just do this for the content. I do it because it's still a day out. It's still a lot of walking and physical activity, and you don't really necessarily get to be in the wild, but you do get to be around trees in a good environment, for at least the parks that I tend to visit. So I do this for myself as well after a while, if I'm honest. I don't necessarily go back for the animals, but yeah, I'll always bring the recorder regardless.
And do you find it helpful to reach out to the zookeepers before you go? So let's say there's a bird exhibition. Would you get some time to record the birds away from the crowds so that you got clean recordings?
It has been a little bit variable with regards to that because of COVID, but just generally, it is possible to get that kind of time without other visitors. It's less likely that you'll be able to get time with the keepers helping you out. The keepers generally will have a very busy schedule. If there is not a lot of people, it also means that probably most of the keepers are not on site that day. So the few that are there will have to do the work of many more. So my success in getting keepers to help me hasn't been great, especially if you try to get an agreement via email before you're even there. What has worked for me is if on the day I happen to stumble on a keeper and they're feeding an animal, I might ask, are you back in the afternoon perhaps? And do you know if the animal tends to vocalize before or after you feed them? Is there any animal that you think in the park may be likely to make a sound today? And more often than not, that leads to good discoveries. And most importantly, it leads you to know when an animal will 100% not make any sound at all. That's fairly reliable as a statement when you hear from someone that works in a park pretty much every day, you know? So that saves you a lot of time.
And so what were some of your favorite animals to record for this collection?
I think I already mentioned the deers, but the deers were really a special occasion as far as I'm concerned, because the enclosure that we visited, it was very, very large. So there was no chance of staying in a static position to record them. In fact, the enclosure was so large that the only way to be close to the animals, or at least as close as possible, was this overhanging wooden bridge. So it kind of dangles left and right as you walk on it with all of your equipment. And all of the equipment is also dangling off of the bridge edges.
That sounds perilous.
So that's kind of spooky in itself. But then we were also staying overnight. So at times we crossed that bridge with a complete darkness. Also because the lights would kind of spook the animals away. So it worked in two ways. But additionally, half of this trail of bridges was also made for kids.
Oh, man.
So at one point, it was kind of like a fork junction type of thing where the right path was pretty much a parkour kind of, you now have to walk on these specific wood logs not to stumble in the net. Of course, there's a safety net, but at the same time, you don't want to walk in the safety net because you'll pretty much get stuck every other step. So it was very interesting because we spent pretty much an entire evening, a whole night and a morning, or at least I did, just kind of going around there and trying to get as close as possible to the animals. We went there with some colleagues, friends from work. We were all trying to record as much as possible. But after a while, it was very tricky also because the bridges are one way kind of street, theoretically at least. So going back and forth is not so easy. And the animals were just... Yeah, I've never really seen deers rutting before, and it gave me the same kind of feeling that I had when I recorded the lion territorial calls for the first time. It's visceral and it's strange. You feel like you're witnessing something that is really unique.
Yeah,
I don't really know how to describe it, but it really makes you feel like you're lucky to be there. And you're just pointing a mic and it's all happening. And I don't know. The great thing about it is that you're not really changing anything about what is happening at that time, if you know what I mean. You're just capturing what would be happening. So that's one of my favorites. Then I think maybe in the same trip, which again was organized originally just to record the red deers, we somehow managed to record the reindeers as well. And that was very interesting because I didn't know that reindeers made much of a sound at all, but they made this kind of chuffing sound that almost is like the tail of a lion territorial call, but not quite. It's a little bit more percussive. And lastly, I think I would say that one of my favorite animals was the mantled gereza, which is a monkey that can make a very, very guttural, croaky kind of sound. It sounds like a frog. The first time that I played it back to a couple of friends, they said, "Is this pitched down? What's the original like?" But no, it was a real time, and it's a very strange kind of... almost burp-like vocalization I really did not expect.
And what was the most challenging animal to record? Or what was the most challenging animal to get close enough to record?
To get close to, perhaps from a not really technical standpoint, but more like caring for your life standpoint, was the rattlesnake. I went to record the rattlesnake when I was in a smaller center, and I asked, we're opening the glass. I get that part. Then I can put the microphones as close as possible, and I can drop them here as well. Or I can keep the mic on the pistol grip. I don't know what you prefer. And the keeper said, "Well, bear in mind that we can't remove the venom from the animal, so it would die without it, from what I understand. So it has venom within it." So at that point, I thought, okay, then you know what? I'm just gonna put the mics here, and if it happens to be on axis, that's fine. And if it's not on axis when it's making the sounds, then we'll make it work, and we'll figure something out. Or maybe I'll tilt a couple of the mics to make sure that we have a bigger range. But that was pretty hard to record because I really did not want to be anywhere close. But I also thought that would be the only occasion for me to record the rattlesnake within the time that I decided to give myself for the library. another animal that I thought was not particularly hard to record, but it was a bad idea to try and record at all, was a single canary. One bird, but a bird that only vocalizes in the context of a group. It's very hard to debird a bird out of the birds that are not the one that you want to have in the take. So that's very complicated also because the, of course, frequency range of the other birds is exactly like the one that you're recording. So every now and then you're seeing the shade of a distant vocalization from another one of the birds, and getting rid of that, cleaning that up, it's very, very tricky.
And so how did you get the single canary to make a sound? Did you hold up pictures of other canaries?
No, sadly, I have to roll with the idea of having others. So I had to do a lot of chopping and remove the ones that were vocalizing whenever the one that I wanted to put in the foreground was also vocalizing, and a lot of RXing. That may be the one animal with the worst ratio in terms of amount of work versus files. I think I must have outputted, I don't know, very few files, but at the same time, I must have spent about 10 hours on it. I don't really know.
Oh, man.
At one point, you stop looking at how much time you're putting in the editing, because then all of the days that you spent outside start to look less sunny, you know?
Yeah. Any funny stories to share about your encounters with the animals while you're out recording?
Oh, funny. A funny story might be that when I went to record marmosets in a smaller park again, this park was a place where the animals were free to roam. So every time that I tried to record them, they would jump on my orca bag, and from there, it was just a mess, generally. And perhaps another one was same place, a meerkat. I've already recorded meerkats in the past, but in this case, I entered that specific enclosure because there were two birds that I wanted to record, and they were making really interesting sounds. And at one point that I was not really recording, I had my headphones on and everything, but I kind of lowered the shotgun I was just resting my hand and thinking about what to do next. I lowered my hand and the shotgun was pointing at one of the holes in which the meerkats were sitting in. And so I start to hear one of them barking, and it sounded like it was the closest recording of a meerkat I've ever had. So that was pretty interesting because I really did not even see them before I made it there. So the barking of the meerkat went on for about half an hour. So after a while, it started to be almost a problem to try and record the birds, but it was not a problem in that case. I think I have a few regrets for this library. At one point, I was very close to hippos in Copenhagen Zoo. From what I gather, they must vocalize something like two or three times a day. And that day, I was near them twice for two vocalizations. But in both cases, when I say near, was about 100 meters. And yeah, I was not even recording. It just sounded incredible. But sadly, I was not prepared for that. I didn't study the animal for long enough. I don't even know specifically what type of vocalization I witnessed. So, you know, happens. Next time, maybe.
Yeah. So coming soon in Animal Hyperrealism 4, we're going to have...
that's a check, I'm afraid I cannot write.
So let's talk about the mic that you use. As with your previous Animal Hyperrealism release, you used the CMPA mic by Avisoft Bioacoustics, which records at 200 kilohertz. Were you using the CM16 or the CM24? And why was this a good mic for capturing animal sounds?
Right, yeah. I've been asked that a couple of times. I think it's good that you ask as well, so that it's in the record. But I think I'm using the 16, and I picked it up for an animal library. Although thinking back to Polarity, which is a electricity-based library that I recorded in the past, I wish I had it back then, because yes, the frequency range is crazy, and of course, recording at 192 kilohertz with a normal a recorder or a sound card won't even enable you to make full use of the mic. When you do have a 384 sound card, then it can be a game changer for things like those. But in the case of animal libraries, I like using this mic because it gives me an isolated high frequency presence that sometimes with the Sunken, because the Sunken has an omni pattern, but is quite sensible to also low end sounds. And sometimes perhaps the wind may affect it a little bit more than the CMPA. You may not get as much definition from a dynamic standpoint. So I like to use the CMPA to try and add that extra level of proximity to the sound. Bear in mind that underneath 1 kHz, this microphone is not usable. It has a lot of small clicks slash self noise that really make it impossible to get anything below 1K to be usable from that mic. So for anyone interested in using this specific mic, I would say it can be great as an addition, but perhaps on its own, it should be used only for recording birds that have a spectrum that fits this limitation, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, interesting. And that's really good to know. Like, definitely thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, of course. The self-noise itself is also fairly high, but I think there's just something in it where if you manage to get everything in axis the right way, then you get really good micro transients in the mid highs and highs section of the spectrum, where you really can get a lot more definition than what you normally can from other mics, even from my 8050 or 8040 from that point of view. I often have to bring down this specific mic in the mix a lot because it captures so much of the highs that you really don't hear, and they're not noise, it's just simply at times unpleasant. So I may even, again, at times high pass this entirely to 20Ks at the point that what I'm doing is I'm pretty much using all of my 8040s, 8050, and the Sunken CO100 in the hearable domain, and in the ultrasonic domain, this mic slowly fades in, and it takes the signal over, and it extends it to 192 kHz.
So let's talk about your mastering process, right? Because you're out there recording with like 5 mics. That's a lot of material that you're bringing back. So, you know, what's your approach to editing these recordings into files that are optimized for sound designers and sound editors?
Yeah, I think that the first part for me is selecting the best takes and getting rid of everything else, of course, like anyone else. After that, it's quite a lot of work, if I'm honest, because in RX, you can't really use multi-channel denoising the way that a field recordist would expect, where training trains each channel based on its individual section. I think it either averages it out or it picks channel number one. I can't remember off the top of my head. So that means that generally, if I am working on one vocalization, I will split all of the mics except for the 8040s, which will be merged into a stereo file, but everything else will be a mono file. So I will end up with, depending on the session, 3 to 4 files. And then I will apply the denoising individually. And also because the CMPA recordings often end up at 192 spectrum, but 384 K sample rate, it means that I cannot merge everything or collapse all of these files into one and do my, for example, spectral repair or spectral editing or anything like that. So it is quite cumbersome as a way of working. I have a lot of Stream Deck shortcuts for doing things like, attenuate this section of the spectrum based on what is above, below, to the left, to the right. Fast declicking, having one click to say train the denoiser based on this section, select everything and denoise, or even select this denoise preset, train everything based on the current selection, select everything, apply the denoise. So there's a lot of things that I try to automate, but I think when it comes to it, it's very hard to have a method that applies to everything and it works flawlessly every time. And because I tend to be quite keen to iron out any issue out of the files, then I end up having to do a lot of manual work that I have not found a way around so far.
And so we talked about the single canary, trying to get a single canary as being the most challenging recordings to edit and master in this collection. Were there any others?
Sometimes pigs can be a little bit hard to clean up, mostly because they tend to move around while they vocalize. And generally, they tend to be walking on either mud or hay or any kind of surface that tends to create a lot of clicks, if there are splashy clicks or crackling clicks, but they ultimately become quite evident in the spectrum. So that becomes a little bit hard to clean up. Another one probably was the camels. The camels have a very low mid focused vocalization, at least the one that I was talking about, that is a mating season type of vocalization. And those ones, if it's a windy day, and it was when I went there to record, and in that case, I didn't want to go back, I ended up having to do a lot of guesswork over, okay, I guess that the low end would follow the mid transients, although my low end is mostly a brick if I was to export the signal that is just below 100 hertz. So I'm going to have to shape the signal below that frequency in function of the higher frequency. Certain things I think took quite a long time to edit because I thought the recording is good enough to be able to get to a good result, but it's not going to be one of those things like the noise and done. It does require a lot of manual drawing and, recreating the waveform, really kind of taking the dinosaur out of the fossil type of thing. I don't really know how to say it, but it really does feel like you're doing that kind of work.
Well, your process and all the care you put into making these sounds is so evident. The types of animals, the sounds they make, and the quality of the sound files. I mean, these recordings are so clean and so close. As I said before, it's like you put the animal in the booth and had it perform for you. So all those hours you spent were not wasted, that's for sure.
Yay! I do feel that way as well. It's very hard to see it when you're, I think, 80% there. When you start to record, I always wanted to draw this kind of graph of the enthusiasm that you have as a field recording, or at least something that applies to me. I'm not sure how many other recordists feel this way, but at the beginning, you have this kind of cautious feeling of, is this even working? Is this a good idea? Am I doing things right? And when you're 20% there and you've gotten one really good sound, you think, I'm invincible. I can go out every day. I'm going to record for the rest of the year. It's going to be incredible. And then perhaps you're 80% there with the recordings and you think, okay, I should probably start editing something. I tend to edit a little bit earlier. I tend to start quite early. I pretty much start editing right away. But at some point, the sessions that you have that are completely unedited brutally overtake the sessions that you have a hold of. And all of a sudden, you just start to think about what the conversion is in between the quality time you spend outside walking in the sun and recording beautiful animals versus being in this kind of, dark room, removing yellow parts in a Rex from an otherwise red spectrum. It's just, I don't know, at times it really kind of gets to a level where you think, who is making me do this? But then I think that's where, in this case, for this library, that's when I got the cover art done for the library, because I thought, when I'll receive it, I'll see it and I'll realize that this is almost done, and that it's a real thing, and then it will give me the motivation boost that I need to make it through the last part. And that's exactly what happened. And then now I'm in that phase of never again in my life, which lasts 1 or 2 months until something happens. Maybe I walk next to a bird outside of work and it makes a cool sound and I think, okay, I'm coming back tomorrow.
So every project offers an opportunity to get better at one's craft. How did Animal Hyperrealism 3 help you to grow as a recordist?
I think coming from the previous ones, it really cemented the concept of low expectations, or just doing something for the sake of liking what you do. I know that I've pretty much just finished a statement about editing that makes it sound like this is a terrible thing to do, and you don't want to ever do it. But realistically, the part that makes me want to go out and record the animals is the animals themselves and being near them. And if I think about it that way, then when I go out, I really feel like I don't have any pressure or expectation. I just like to go out. I like to explore what, in this case, Sweden had to offer. Maybe next time it will be, you know, outside of Sweden. But in this case, I decided to limit myself to Sweden and a little bit of Denmark. But I think working with what you have, or at least not trying to travel too much for this specific library, has taught me that if you're patient and you give yourself enough time, then you can get good results. You don't have to schedule a one-hour session with someone that trains birds for movies like Harry Potter to get good results. You may get results that are as good if you have one day in a park. There are two very different experiences, but in one case, you may have some form of guarantee that something will come of the session. In another one, perhaps not, but I think it really kind of helped me understand that at times it's just nice to not have that kind of control. And other than that, I think it also helped me to get even better at managing my time outside of working hours from my full-time job. Again, I do this because I enjoy it, but because I tend to be quite analytical about my editing phase, sometimes that's a bit of a slippery slope where if you become a little bit too fixated about an issue or the quality you want to get or a deadline that you have set for yourself, I don't have, you know, anyone telling me when I need to release a library. But after a while, I like to think, oh, wouldn't it be nice to send it out by April? If all of these things find the wrong balance in your life, I think it can make an otherwise incredibly pleasant job into a bit of a nightmare. You can be your worst boss from that point of view. So I think as far as I'm concerned, this also helped me because I never really felt like I had no energy at work because I was working on this library. In fact, I would use days where I had a lot of meetings at work to come home and flex a bit of muscles in editing. And vice versa, if I, for example, had a long day where I did a lot of sound design at work, I would come home and maybe do metadata editing or something else. So from that point of view, I think it really helped me find even more of a balance, although it did take more than a year to make the library as a result, because of course I would only do it when I felt that I had the energy and I was in the mood.
Well, Mattia, congratulations, seriously, on another amazing animal hyperrealism library. And thank you so much for sharing your time and your story with me.
Thank you. It was great to share it.
That's it for this episode. A big thanks to Jennifer Walden for doing the interview and to Mattia Cellotto for being on the show.
Looking for more audio-related podcasts to listen to? We're part of the Audio Podcast Alliance, featuring a hand-picked selection of the very best podcasts about sound. So be sure to hear the latest episodes from our friends in the community at audiopodcast.org.
Be sure to subscribe to the Sound Effect Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks a lot for listening and see you next time. Take care.